toward the gates to the fort. Arne watched him go, wondering what had driven him to make the choice he'd just made. 12. Glacier Mountains, southeast of Endar, Yor 415, early spring. Galad looked out over the seemingly endless columns of Kragan's army as it sluggishly snaked northwest up the deep valleys toward the high country, within which lay Endar Pass, with his 1,500 mist warriors well hidden among the trees of the forest. The time had come to slow the massive vorgs and men even further. Their overwhelming numbers gave them confidence. Galad was about to impart a healthy dose of doubt. Lycus, he said to the time shaper. Summon the mists. She stared outward, her eyes taking on a faraway look as her hands and fingers traced intricate patterns in the air. Amidst the weaving, the fogs flowed. The passage of time slowed within the Pommelly mists and accelerated in the Reikley mists, and everywhere those mists flowed, what lay within disappeared. Galad took one last look at the layout of Kragan's closest troops as the many variations of the mists obscured them, confirming that Lycus's channeling matched the pattern that Galad and his warrior brigade had rehearsed. He signaled to his subordinate commanders and led his warriors into the mists. As Galad stepped forward, he felt the slower zone he was leaving drag at his body. Within the variances of the Reikley mists, Galad slowed his march to avoid getting far out in front of his warriors, who had not yet entered the faster zone. It was as if they stepped through translucent curtains. From Galad's perspective, he was never in a fog. When he stepped across a new boundary, it cleared, and the zone he had departed misted over. But all around him, other mists twisted and turned according to the will of the timeshaper who channeled them. On his left, a light gray mist blocked his view back into the world where the normal passage of time held sway, while a few paces to his right, a faster Reikley zone was a darker shade of gray. That variance in shade was one of the ways that mist warriors determined the best path to take. The lighter the mist, the slower time passed within. Galad cut across his current passage and transitioned into the next Reikley zone, following a pattern that took advantage of the way Lycus's mists flowed. The shape of these passages was critically important. It did a fighting group of mist warriors no good to move rapidly along a Reikley passage that ran straight into a large enemy force. Thus, Lycus created a series of winding mists that hid the Endarians until the moment that they fell upon their enemy. The time difference between adjacent mists could not be so large as to make the wall between them impenetrable. Galad and his fighters routinely operated in Reikley mists, where time passed a half dozen times faster than normal, which was why mist warriors aged more quickly than other Endarians. As Galad approached the area he had targeted for his main thrust, he pulled his bow off his shoulder and moved forward at a run. All around him, warriors followed their well-rehearsed paths, disappearing and reappearing as they wove their way through the subtle variations in the Reikley fog. When the mists appeared, they flowed down from the high ridges to the northwest of Kragan's army. For days, he had been expecting just such an attack, but the Endarians had held back. The strategy had kept the Vorgs and men who composed the bulk of his army on edge, costing them sleep. The scouting parties that Charna had sent out to find the Endarians had come back empty-handed, or not come back at all. Far behind his forward lines, Kragan called upon the air elemental Oak, forming an invisible set of stairs that he climbed to a height of 10 paces. From this perch, he studied what was happening to his leading troops. He had seen all this long ago, when the Endarians had tried to destroy him and his treasured city of Lagoth. He licked his lips. This time, he would teach them a lesson. As the tendrils of mist penetrated into the front lines of his soldiers, Kragan saw the haze obscure hundreds of the Talion conscripts. A fireball arched into the sky, one of his wielders launching heat at the Endarian warriors, likely to be moving within those mists. When it contacted the fog bank, the fireball deflected, exploding near its launch point, engulfing Cragen's nearby soldiers in flames. The sight pulled a curse from his mouth. Khalil's voice rumbled in his mind.
I see that one of your wielders did not pay attention when you instructed them that no elemental magic can penetrate the boundaries between time mists.
Silap, I will deal with her later.
You may not get the opportunity.
Looking at the swath the fireball had cut through his troops, Cragen scowled. Normally, he would not have placed a wielder near the front lines, but since elementals could only perform magic within the time zone within which they were summoned, Cragen needed to spread wielders throughout his columns. The Andarians suffered from similar limitations. They could only fight when they and their enemies shared the same rate of time's passage. That meant wielders needed to be with the troops whom the Andarians might attack. A league to the north of where Cragen stood suspended in the air, the mists cleared, revealing Italian company far ahead of where they should be. Cragen understood. They had been moving through what the Andarians called a Reichli mist, where a timeshaper had accelerated time's passage. While they believed they marched forward at the same pace as their brothers in arms, they had advanced far beyond the rest of the army. But there was no sign of the Andarian warriors. Then, as Cragen watched, another of the wispy tendrils consumed those forward troops. Finally, the start of the fight he had been anticipating. As badly as he wanted to jump into the fray, now was the time to observe and learn how the commander of these mist warriors operated. For that knowledge, Cragen would gladly sacrifice as many Talion conscripts as necessary. 100 of his troops formed a single rank with Gallad at its center as he studied the nuances of the mist. The vision that formed in his mind confirmed that this was the place to launch his attack. As he raised his bow in preparation for stepping into the time mist that Cragen's soldiers now occupied, his warriors mirrored his motion. They strode forward as one, feeling the pressure that went with stepping from a faster zone into a slower one. To the eyes of their enemies, his warriors would appear to have stepped through a curtain at normal speed, but the Vorgs and men who made up that foul army could not anticipate when or from which direction the attack would come. As the pressure normalized, the mist rolled away to reveal a close approximation of what Gallad had expected. The march of several hundred of Cragen's troops had faltered as they looked about in confusion. In rapid succession, Gallad's warriors launched three volleys of arrows, concentrated upon the area occupied by one of Cragen's magic wielders and the soldiers who protected him. Then, without waiting for the enemy response, Gallad turned and stepped back into the Reichli mist, from which he had just come, accompanied by his 100 warriors. The mist he left behind clung to him, striving to prevent him from entering a space where he could move more freely. As soon as he freed himself from the fog that tugged at his backside, Gallad raced to his right, getting clear of the area where the enemy archers were sure to return fire, knowing that he and his warriors moved fast enough to get away before any arrows could emerge from the slower zone. Glancing back, he saw a storm of arrows slowly emerge into the zone, where time passed at a much quicker pace. But the transition had robbed them of most of their momentum. Too late and off target, they dropped to the ground at a fraction of the distance they would have traveled had they not made the transition. Other arrows slowly sprouted from the mist as Cragen's archers began firing wildly in all directions, but Gallad and his warriors easily avoided their paths. As the storm of shafts died out, Gallad signaled for his warriors to ready for the attack. Once again, they raised their bows, but this time they did not move back into the slowing fog. Instead, they waited. A sudden rush of human warriors clawed their way into the Reichli zone, but as they fought themselves clear of the thick soup that bound them, Andarian arrows suddenly pierced their necks and other areas where their armor was insufficient to deflect the flying barbs. Mist warriors, who had exchanged their bows for Andarian swords, rapidly dispatched those humans who fought their way out of the clinging soup. Once more, Galad signaled his troops, and they followed him into yet another of the Reichly mists as a Pommelie zone flowed in behind them, further isolating the confused human survivors. Racing along the winding path that led back to the mountain forest from which he had launched the attack, Galad felt satisfied with all that his company had just accomplished. Emerging into normal time, concealed by the thick woods, he and his warriors were the first to arrive at the rally point he had designated. Over the next hour and a half, the other companies emerged from the mist to join him. By the time all his commanders had reported in, the tally had become clear. Except for one company that had emerged from the mist into a storm of fireballs and lightning from two of Kragan's wielders, casualties had been light. But the losses among that unfortunate company had been horrific. Only 23 of those warriors had survived. Almost all of that contingent who had struggled back to the rally point were wounded, and their company commander, Jaylen, was among the fallen. Shunting aside the sorrow that he would allow himself to feel once his brigade was safely away, Galad led his remaining warriors, still more than 1,300 strong, out of the foothills and back into the glacier mountains. Although today he had inflicted far more casualties on Kragan's army than he had sustained, he knew it was only the bite of an annoying fly. Next time, he would have to do better. 13. Endless Valley, Yore 415, Mid-Spring. Arn found himself seated atop Axe, gazing down the ridgeline to the west, the same general direction that he had scanned for any sign of motion. Arn could feel Slaken occupying its customary place, strapped in a sheath at his side. Today it tugged at him, the four elementals bound within the runes on its haft, hungering for the lives that the weapon would take in the coming days. He drew the big knife from its sheath, turning it over in his hands to study it. Slaken was his one magical possession, its very existence as ironic as his own. The dull blade, darker than a starless night, absorbed light rays, leaching them into the handle. There they warped and twisted, dancing along the strange runes carved into its surface. The effect was fluid, as if light flowed along the narrow channels the script cut into the weapon's landscape. Overcome with gratitude that Arn had saved the life of his only son, King Rodan of Tal had granted him the right to have any one thing the monarch could give. What Arn had asked for had taken Gregor, Rodan's magic wielder, and the kingdom's chief armorer, years to make. The black blade with the carved handle, a handle with so many magical runes that one blended into the next. The blade was so magical that it had no magic, offering sorcery so twisted in upon itself that one spell blocked another until none worked. In fact, no spell had any effect upon the knife, nor upon the person who had made the blood bond with the weapon, and only Arn could hold the blade. Slaken gave Arn the one thing he desired most in the world— the ability to operate without the direct interference of wielders. Arn pulled himself from the trance where his study of the runed haft had placed him, turning his thoughts back to the task that Raefel had assigned him in a sudden meeting. Arn's departure from Ariana's Vale had happened so suddenly that it had left a hollow ache in his heart, along with a growing dread. Carol had been present at the meeting with Raefel and Gar, and even though no one had disagreed with the course of action that the High Lord had decided upon, the decision was painful for both Arn and Carol. The thought of being sent on a mission that separated him from the loved one he had vowed to protect made him physically ill. The Rangers had spotted the lead scouts of the Army of the Protectors no more than 2 days west of Ariana's Vale. As he sat atop his mount, Arn knew that the Horde would be reaching the outer boundaries of the Great Forest in a few hours. Moving fast and recklessly, they were seeking early contact with Raefel's scouts. Such was not to be. The High Lord had given the order that he wanted no advance contact with the enemy lead elements. He wanted to let them enter the narrow ravine at full speed, so that when they hit the walls of the lower fortress, they would be well beyond the assistance of the main body of their army. Before that happened, though, he wanted Arn out of the Vale. The plan made sense. Carol would position herself high on an outcropping behind the fortifications, where everyone could see her clearly. There she would make her magical stand, giving hope to friendly forces, and striking fear into the heart of the enemy. The downside was that she would face constant mystical assault from every spell-casting priest the protectors could throw at her. They would attempt to kill her first, and, failing that, keep her so busy that she could not help with the main battle. That led to Arn's mission. As much as he wanted to be near Carol and protect her during the fight, it made more sense for him to be away from the canyon before the enemy forces blocked the exit. In that way, he could infiltrate behind their lines, killing as many of the priests as possible before and during the fight. The best way to help even the odds, which were so heavily stacked against his true love. He spurred the horse forward into a ground-covering canter, directly toward the line of giant trees that spread out north and south, just a league in front of him. The powerful beast moving beneath him, the creak of the leather saddle, and the musty smell of horse sweat all brought back feelings that he had not felt for a long time, heightening his awareness. He entered the first of the long shadows that blocked the orange rays of the sinking sun. Entering the woodline, he turned south, the sound of his passing muffled in the deep needles that the mighty evergreens had deposited over the millennia. He wanted to make haste in order to bypass the Protector's army to the south. All through the night he rode, though darkness slowed his progress to a steady trot. An hour before dawn, he passed out of the great forest, entering a set of rolling hills and broad valleys. The birds ignored his passage, or perhaps their boisterous conversations were about him. Whatever the true nature of their calls, the volume of their singing was impressive, as though they were determined to make everyone aware that spring had arrived and it was time to celebrate. Looking out to the west, a great valley spread out away from him, with herds of deer grazing casually along with antelope and the strange woolly cattle that frequented these lower altitudes. None of the animals showed any of the concern that they would exhibit if masses of vorgs or armies of soldiers moved anywhere near them. Arn turned west. Once again, he quickened the pace, racing into the west on the back of Axe, who had never tired in all the times that Arn had sat astride him. Muscle rippled beneath skin like bunches of wire, a visual effect that did nothing to enhance the handsomeness of the horse, but which whispered of unimaginable reserves of power and endurance. The sun passed overhead in its great arc, not directly, but a bit to the south, reaching its zenith as Arn turned back to the north. He paused at a small stream to water the horse and to refill his water pouch, and then he was racing northward once more. He moved back into the rolling hill country, hills covered with juniper on the north side, but which were mostly barren of trees on the sunny southern side. Rounding the military crest of one of these, he spotted the Vorgs. A group of 20 warriors raced southward, running in formation with great urgency. Arn dismounted, tying Axe in the trees, and slipping forward to a spot where he could watch them unseen. This enemy patrol made no sense. Why was an elite hunter-killer platoon on some urgent mission racing in the wrong direction? From the look of them, they were an exceptional unit. All big, heavily armored, and well-disciplined. A very unusual setup for Vorgs. They were after someone or something. Arn wondered if he had been spotted. It was possible, but doubtful. These Vorgs looked like they knew exactly where they were heading, and it wasn't toward him. Most likely they had some talisman that served as a compass, guiding them to their quarry. The sort of thing the priests could have provided them. He knew we should get moving, but something bothered him, worry worming into his mind in a way that he could not ignore. Something bad was about to happen. A sudden headache hammered his temples, so that his vision blurred, producing a cold sweat that poured from his brow. He had to get moving north again. Carol needed him. He could not let her fight alone the dozens of priests that would engage her. But as he looked back at the running formation of Vorgs, his intuition would not let him resume his original task. For some reason, that small Vorg battle group posed a greater threat to the love of his life than all the protectors combined. Though the decision was chewing his guts out, he would leave Carol to fend for herself. A thought filled him with fury and frustration. Was Slakin playing with his intuition, making him act rashly? After all, Carol had said that the four elementals bound within its runes were full of rage. Did they want her dead just to punish him? He wavered, analyzing his feelings. No. The call that pushed him to pursue the Vorgs came from within himself. The tug of his intuition had never betrayed him. With a kick of his heels, Arn turned to follow the Vorgs south. 14. Ariana's Veil. Yore 415. Mid-spring. The swish thunk of an arrow embedding itself in wood pulled Rafel's attention. A lone arrow, the shaft shattered from impact, was embedded in the log wall of the fort. High in the north rim of the canyon, a man with a bow waved and disappeared from view. Derek Scott had come up with the idea for the ingenious battlefield messaging system and had been assigned to lead the ranger platoon whose task was to make it work. A group of 15 rangers had made the four-day ride out of the Vale and up through the high passes to the tops of the cliffs. These men were now spread out in high observation posts along the western tops of those cliff walls, 5,000 feet above where Rafel stood, so that he could observe what was happening in the lowlands leading up to the canyon entrance. As needed, Derek would dispatch a messenger to a point where he could fire an arrow down into selected locations in the lower fortifications, where the attached note would be retrieved and relayed to Rafel, Gar, or Hannibal. Duncan, Rafel's aide, climbed down the ladder, retrieved the note attached to the broken shaft of the arrow, and returned to Rafel's side at the top of the outermost defensive wall of the lower fort. Rafel perused the message and turned to Gar and Hannibal, who stood near him atop the fortifications.
"A disorganized group of several hundred Vorgs and men have reached the entrance to the canyon, running hard with no thought of waiting for the main forces far behind them. They'll be on us in about a half hour. Signal the high archers that I don't want them engaged until they hit the wall right here. Hannibal, you have the forward command. Remember, let them hit this wall. When you open fire, that will be the signal for the archers you have positioned along the higher trails to open up with their enfilading attack. I don't want any of the rock slides used. You will only release those when several thousand Vorgs are jammed up in the canyon below the forts."
"Understood," said Hannibal, turning to relay orders to his subordinate commanders.
Rafel turned back toward Gar, noting the swift gaze of pride that crinkled the weathered stone of the old warrior's face in an almost imperceptible shift. If he had not known his comrades so well, he might have believed that he imagined the sight.
"The people of the Khonju tribe?" he asked. "The last of our cliff-dwelling neighbors passed through our upper gates and were taken to their camp in the Vale more than an hour ago," said Gar. "It was mainly the elderly in the last group. I gather that Chief Dan had considerable difficulty in convincing several of the ancient ones to leave their cliff homes. The last report said that a couple of dozen stayed behind despite his efforts."
"That is sad, but not surprising. Some folks would rather die than flee, and others just won't believe what's about to happen." Rafel sighed. "They're as good as dead now."
He looked around. It was a good, strong fort. They had not built their defenses from stone, but log walls were strong, and they would have to do. The clatter of metal filled the air as soldiers moved about in their chainmail, bearing iron-bound shields, fine steel swords, and the occasional bit of plate armor. Troops clustered together atop the battlements, shoulder to shoulder. Bowmen filled all the slotted firing positions, with more archers positioned in higher places farther to the rear. Along the tight paths they had cut into the face of the cliff, bowmen manned firing positions that were beyond the outer fortress walls. These positions were difficult to get to, and difficult to assault, and they provided no means to retreat from battle. The men who fought there knew that they would have little chance of surviving the main assault. Even farther out and higher on the cliffs, above places where the enemy would jam up during the main fight, boulders had been undercut so that they could be dislodged by a single man, generating rock slides to plunge into the gorge below. Soldiers manned all of these high positions, but Rafel had no intention of using them in the initial fight. The mid-morning sun beat down hot today, although Rafel recognized that most of his heat came from the chain and plate armor he wore over his leather clothing. War was never a comfortable thing, and grew more uncomfortable as he aged. Or perhaps his memory inflated the glory of battles past and minimized the aches and pains he had endured. He and Gar separated, making the rounds of the men, patting them on the back, shaking their hands, giving the words of encouragement that leaders were meant to give to those who would soon struggle for their lives and the lives of their loved ones. Rafel knew that their hearts now thrummed in their chests as adrenaline surged through their veins, leaving a sick feeling of anticipation and dread. Together, they endured the most difficult of all parts of battle, the waiting before combat began. Rafel looked back up the canyon toward Ariana's Vale, toward the jutting ledge that extended outward from the southern wall, just to the east of the uppermost of the layered sections of the canyon defenses, to the spot where Carol would make her stand. He had ordered her to remain away for the first skirmish. She needed to rest for the subsequent battles. The lonely ledge where his daughter would present herself as destroyer and target filled his soul with terror. How many of the priests had Arn said the protectors could muster against her? Over 100? Perhaps many more. Some powerful in their own magics, while others were mere novices. His only consolation was the thought of Arn finding his way to the heart of the most dangerous of these enemies. He had sent forth his most deadly weapon, the assassin who had never failed him in all the years of their acquaintance, and one who was devoted to Carol's safety. No, Arn would not fail them. The warbling sound of a horn was accompanied by a rattling chorus of armor as every man in the fortress straightened at the sound. Vorg war horns were hardly things of beauty, either to behold or hear, carved as they were from human femurs, and sounding something akin to the squeal of a wild hog. Rafel climbed to the command deck, a raised platform behind the main wall, but elevated so that he could survey the entire scene through a slotted turret that jutted forward, providing views along a variety of angles. Much as he wanted to be on the main wall for this first attack, it made no sense for either himself or Gar to do so. A time would come when his sudden arrival at the forward wall would bolster men whose hopes had faded. But this was not that time. This was Hannibal's time. The lead Vorgs had rounded the bend in the canyon about half a league to the west of the fort. This first group slowed, as they were forced to cross the stream, swollen by spring runoff. It plunged through the gorge in a fury of rapids, switching back and forth across the canyon's width. By the time the entire group managed to cross, their numbers had swollen to several hundred as stragglers from behind caught up. The sound of the horns grew as more Vorgs arrived and made the crossing, stretching out along the narrow slivers of land that led beside the stream toward the fort that rose up to block the canyon to the east. Rafel watched as Hannibal and his commanders worked the line of defenders on the wall, passing among the men, reinforcing their orders with repetition.
"Hold! Do not fire until I give the command!"
Gar moved up beside Rafel.
"Something isn't right here."
"I see it," Rafel said. The Vorgs had stopped their headlong advance a little over a quarter league from the fort. "I've never known Vorgs to be able to hold like that when their blood was up."
"There,"
Gar said, pointing to a spot behind where the Vorgs were gathering. A lone rider in a dark cloak trailed behind them, stopping at a point where he could gaze up the canyon toward the fort.
"Ah, not quite as stupid as we thought. Our enemy sent a priest to ride herd on this lot. He's wanting to draw us out, to force us to come out and engage this bunch forward of the fort." "Or he's waiting for reinforcements,"
said Gar.
Rafel turned to Duncan.
"Get Carol up here."
The young aide leapt down the ladder, disappearing along the winding street below. By the time Carol climbed onto the command deck, the number of Vorgs had grown to almost 1,000. They had moved into formation, picking up a guttural chant with the banging of shields serving as percussion accompaniment. The priest sat his mount 100 paces behind their formation. "I think they want to draw me out," Carol said. "They're using these vorgs as bait so they can see how I confront them magically."
"If we do nothing," said Rafel, "they'll study our defenses while they wait for the arrival of the main force."
Carol closed her eyes, moving into the trance-like state that the High Lord had seen before. The charge began with just 2 vorgs, but it was like the crack in the dam that, once breached, brought forth a flood. The vorgs howled and charged, actions that were transmitted to those adjacent to them so rapidly that it seemed as if all the invaders made up their minds as one. The priest in the back gestured wildly, but they paid no heed.
"What happened?" asked Rafel.
"Something they didn't expect," said Carol, opening her eyes.
"Hold!"
Annabelle's command rang out like the toll of a steeple bell. When the first of the vorgs reached the wall, swinging grappling hooks on ropes, he gave another command.
"Fire!"
The archers unleashed a volley from atop the walls, and a wave of vorgs fell. Another volley of arrows from the cliffs behind the invaders raked their flanks. Several grappling hooks lodged on the top of the main wall, but soldiers severed the lines with sword and axe. The vorg spread out along the wall on a 30-pace stretch of land that separated the cliff from the raging mountain stream. Several tried to work their way around the log wall and across to the far bank, but a swarm of arrows from the section of fort that obstructed the stream's south bank bit into them. Others fell into the rapids, where the fury of the torrent pulled them under the roiling waters. The vorgs who made it to the base of the fortress next to the stream engaged in a brief but furious exchange of arrows with Hannibal's archers, but fell without making their way to the top of the walls. Movement in the distance drew Rafel's gaze as the priest turned his horse and fled, his dark cloak flapping behind him as he rode. A single bolt of lightning split the sky, sending horse and rider tumbling into the stream, not to reemerge. The remaining vorgs ran. As they broke away from the walls, Hannibal raised his sword and the winch crew lowered the drawbridge, spewing forth 100 of Rafel's cavalry. They charged out after the fleeing warriors, their bodies flung low across the necks of their warhorses. In minutes, the battle was over, an eerie stillness replacing the cacophony that had preceded it.
"Duncan, get me a report on our wounded and killed. Also, tell Hannibal I want the vorg stripped of any useful weapons, especially crossbows, bows, and arrows. Then I want their heads placed atop spears and stuck in the ground between here and the mouth of the canyon. Tell him to post outriders, and be quick about it. I don't want them caught out in the open."
As Duncan departed, Rafel turned to Carol.
"Do you mind telling me what you did there?"
"Let's just say I ruffled their feathers a bit. Now, if you don't need me, I'll return to my preparations for the battle that is yet to come." Rafel stared at his daughter for a moment, but as it became obvious that no further information on this subject would be forthcoming, he waved her away. He was familiar with wielders calling forth lightning, wind, and fire. However, the way Carol had caused the vorgs to defy the priest and attack made the hair on the nape of his neck stand straight out. As he watched Carol climb down the ladder, he realized that he did not want to know what power she had just wielded. Carol watched as nightfall draped the battlements. An inkiness penetrated only by the twinkling pinpricks of the stars in the rift of sky. The strict light discipline exercised by Rafel's forces gave mute testimony to his soldiers' training. No one lit a torch nor struck flint to steel. Within the lower fort, night reigned supreme. Deafening noise echoed from the ravine's walls. The army of the protectors had entered the lower section of the canyon in late afternoon, and although they had not yet made their way around the nearest switchbacks, the hammering of their drums and chants now rose in volume so that the canyon vibrated in accompaniment. The first ripples of torchlight skittered across the rocks at the near bend in the canyon, dim creepers followed by the glow of hundreds of torches. The light crawled across thousands of figures that jammed both sides of the roaring stream. Dread radiated outward from the scene, sending chills up Carol's spine. The horde lay great ramps across the stream and poured over them. Still a half league west of the lower fort, they moved inexorably forward, dragging with them siege engines, ladders, and more wooden ramps. Gasps and murmurs whispered along the tops of the fortress walls. They subsided as the leaders moved among their men, bolstering their will with the confidence of old soldiers who masked their fear at the scene unfolding beyond their walls. With a thought, Carol bathed the top of the stone pinnacle in a soft radiance. She stood gallantly, her long-sleeved white blouse hanging loosely over her leather riding pants, her white cape swirling in a gentle breeze, arms upraised for all to see. Beside her, clad in her color-shifting uniform that had changed to brown, sat a peaceful Kim, her long auburn hair framing her features. A cheer arose from the battlements, and Carol amplified the sound so that it crashed back and forth between the cliffs, loosing rivulets of stone, which rattled down to the canyon floor. In answer to her casting, clouds boiled over the cliffs above the Vorgs, webbed by sheet lightning. The building storm surged toward her. The leading edge of the horde reached a point just 100 paces beyond the walls of the lower fort and halted in a mass that suddenly bristled with bows. The torchbearers moved among them, and 1,000 arrows blazed with fire. Carol gestured, and the flames died. Then the storm erupted. Lightning bolts cascaded onto her pinnacle, accompanied by thunder that shook the stone beneath her feet. The bolts struck at Carol like angry snakes, but failed to penetrate the translucent orb that shielded the two women. Electrical energy crawled along the glittering surface of the bubble, ever seeking, but finding no inward path. A horn blared from within the lower fort, and Raffles' archers launched volley after volley from the tops of its ramparts, cutting a swath through the Vorgs below as lightning illuminated the battlefield. The enemy archers released their arrows, but without the burning brands, they had little effect upon the defenders. The protectors focused their sorcery on trying to dislodge Carol from her lofty perch, but she struck back, sending a fireball into the stream beside them. The resulting jet of superheated steam threatened to envelop them, but they deflected it directly into a group of their soldiers, cooking the Vorgs inside the shells of their armor. The smell of roasted meat wafted through the rift, carried aloft on the wind. Carol longed to lash out with all her might to decimate the foul beings crammed into the visible part of the gorge, but she could not allow the priests to sap her strength, not while they kept the vast bulk of their army in reserve. The small group of protectors, against whom she now sparred, were but a probe that their high priest had sent to test and tire her. The Vorgs reached the closed drawbridge, the weight of the mod pressing forward until the wood cracked under the pressure. Raffles' archers targeted the ladder-bearers, their fires so effective at killing the incoming horde that only the crews protected by wooden ramps reached the outer walls. As groups of humans and Vorgs raised the ramps into position, Hannibal's troops poured forth buckets of grease. Swordsmen, with good footing, met the first of the slipping and sliding Vorgs to reach the top of the wall. As those Vorgs fell, their blood added to the slipperiness of the ramps. These soon became so slick that the invaders only managed to make their way forward across the backs of their fellows. The cluster of ramps against the walls left few places for more ladders, jamming up the assault so that a great mass spilled in the canyon below. Suddenly, something surged through that mass. 3 of the thickly muscled, 10-foot-tall humanoids known as Grunns trampled the Vorgs before them, crushing their way toward the raised drawbridge. Ignoring the volleys of arrows that buzzed into their hides, the Grunns reached the closed portal, battering it with their powerful arms and shoulders. The thick wood cracked and splintered. Carol launched a series of fireballs at the protectors, forcing them to throw up a shield of their own. Then she shifted her attack, hurling lightning bolts into the Grunns, sending their charred bodies crashing to the ground. However, the damage they had inflicted on the drawbridge had severely weakened it. Again the priest struck out at her, forcing her to strengthen her own shielding. As she did, A group of running Vorgs raced forward, carrying a metal-tipped log, shattering the weakened planks, and opening a 6-foot-wide hole into the lower fort. Kara watched in horror as the Vorgs flooded into the gap. Anglok wore the cloak of Jardin Scott's body with long familiarity, moving through the darkness with the stealth of a ghost. The spell was a simple one. He had merely to summon the air elemental Nematomus to cloak his body with invisibility. The protector was easily able to slip away from the crowd of soldiers during the fighting. In the midst of all the ensuing commotion of the battle, he had crept eastward through the upper 2 forts that blocked the ravine that led into Ariana's Vale, crossing each drawbridge in turn. Inside his core, he fumed, his guts writhing. The witch on the pinnacle had robbed him of what was rightfully his. How many days and nights had he snuck away to creep in close to Kim, watching her bathe? He had even snuck into her cabin to watch her make love to her little weasel of a lover, which had almost driven him to kill John and take her right there atop his bloody corpse. It wasn't duty that stopped him, even though his duty weighed heavily upon him. Fear was what stayed his hand, although it was not fear of the Witch of the Vale. Nothing in this miserable hole inspired fear in him, but fear of the Master. That was another thing entirely. None who had intimately beheld Quilzy Ghoul could do aught but tremble at the Dark God's wrath. Therefore, Anglok had held himself in check so that he could play his part in the upcoming battle, all the while consoling himself with the knowledge that he would make this Andarian woman his plaything when the time was right, when it would not spoil everything. Tonight was to be the night, that perfect time when, in the midst of the battle confusion, he could entice Kim away with a summoning. But the witch had ruined everything. Who would have thought that she would keep Kim beside her in the battle? The selfish bitch had confiscated the Andarian to draw upon her healing powers, not letting her bastard half-sister tend to the soldiers who were even now fighting and dying far below the spire upon which the 2 women perched. The strategy was something he himself would have employed. He had been an imbecile to fall for the myth that Carol was somehow different and would give herself selflessly for her people. What an absolute fool he had been. Anglok passed through the last of the canyon forts like a midnight caress, a whisper that raised the hair on the necks of a few guards, causing them to glance around nervously. Moving out through the easternmost gate, the priest turned south, going around the base of the section of cliff that branched away from the main wall to form the spire upon which both the object of his desire and the target of his malice maintained their lofty purchase. Finding the steep trail that led up the backside, he started to climb. Okay. He would simply have to reorder his plans. Kill the witch first, then take the Andarian. A ragged smile distorted his features. This could work out far better than he had imagined. How would it go? Jardin Scott arrives at the top of the spire with a critical message from High Lord Raefel. Carol lets him inside her defenses, and as he steps close to whisper the message, he shoves his dagger deep into her throat. Then, high above the battle where all could see, he would bathe them in a different kind of light than that of the White Witch. The blood-red glow would let all watch him toss down one of Raefel's daughters, and then take his sweet time with the other. All the while, Quilzy Ghoul's army would parry with the disenheartened defenders below. His heart thrummed in his chest as he picked up the pace. Yes, this was going to be sweet. 15. Valdep, you're 415, mid-spring.
What?
Alan bellowed, causing the Khan's guards to reach for their weapons.
You will do as I command, said Khan,
holding out his arms so that his squire could finish fastening his chest plate in place.
Your father sent you here in exchange for my son, that each of us could have a piece of ourselves in the other's home. As we speak, all but a few of my able-bodied warriors sit mounted on the plain below, ready to ride with me to the aid of your people. but you will not be among them. You will continue, as my son continues, to reside in the house of the other, spilling your blood only in defense of the other, and not in defense of your own."
Alan felt the veins in his neck bulge, as if the blood inside them boiled.
"Much as you want to fight for your people, you will stay here and defend mine on the off chance that I should fail, and the Vorg attack turns toward this stronghold. One of my blood fights for your people. One of Raphael's blood shall stand ready to do the same for mine. So the two of us have spoken. So shall it be."
"If you fail, then we'll all die anyway," said Alan. "Counting my 30 soldiers, you can only leave a couple of hundred warriors behind to protect several thousand women, children, and old men. Even these mighty battlements cannot stand against such a force as the protectors will throw against them."
"What you say may be true, but I will not leave them undefended by a man of royal blood. There are two of us here of royal blood. You, the son of the leader of your people, and myself. If I am not to stay, then you must."
The Khan grasped his helm and battle axe and turned back to Alan.
"Make the most of the time that you have. Get my people ready for whatever may come. I must leave them in your hands, as you must leave your people's fate in mine. Let us not disappoint each other."
Alan felt rooted to the floor as he watched the Khan stride from the room, picking up a cadre of warriors as he departed, his squire trailing behind. Having forgotten Tai's presence, Alan suddenly noticed that the barbarian had moved up beside him.
"We all have our tasks," Tai said. "Don't make the mistake of underestimating those that your father and the Khan have assigned you."
Then Tai turned and strode from the room, following in the Khan's wake. Shrugging free of his imagined fetters, Alan moved to the balcony of the Khan's council chamber. It perched high on the wall of a tower that afforded a masterful view of the valley beyond the outer walls of the fortress. Spread out atop that plain, several thousand horsemen stoically sat atop their mounts, long hair and beards hanging down over shoulder and chest, battle axes slung across their backs or hanging in straps from their saddles.
"Khan!"
The cry echoed off the stone walls of the fortress as the Khan appeared atop his warhorse, riding out on the causeway below. With no pause, he lengthened the steed's stride to a gentle canter, sweeping along the front ranks of his men and then looping back toward Ariana's Vale. From right to left, the companies of riders fell in behind him, forming a mighty column of death on horseback, a column that soon disappeared around the bend to the south, leaving a yawning maw of silence in its wake. Alongside them rode the shirtless Qanjari. Alan felt he should have been among them. It was all he could do to keep from riding out after Tai, but such an act would only let his father down once again. 16. Glacier Mountains, southeast of Endar, Eor 415, mid-spring. As Oak created a magical lens that served as his farglass, Cragen watched the forward edge of the battle unfold before his eyes. For these weeks that the Yandarian Mist Warriors had nipped at his flanks, Cragen's forces had failed to crush them. Their timeshaper had proven to be a true master of the craft, slicing off chunks of Cragen's army, confusing and isolating groups of soldiers so that the Yandarians could sweep in and destroy them. Cragen had even lost two of his wielders to the attacks, but the men and Vorgs whom Cragen had sacrificed had served their intended purpose. These battles had revealed a subtle pattern in the Master Timeshaper's magic. Khalil's thoughts whispered in his head,
"Dog awaits your command.
First we wait and observe. Only after confirmation will I strike."
As the time mists rolled down from the forested hillside to the northwest of the lead elements of Cragen's army, Charna signaled for those troops to charge. It was a mad move that would only play into the hands of the Mist Warriors' commander. In the next few hours, thousands of Talian conscripts would die within the fogs. But as Kraken hoped, the Indarian timeshaper reacted with an eagerness to enfold those who charged within her nebulous tentacles. And the pattern of those tendrils allowed Kraken to determine from whence they flowed. Kraken called forth Oak to encase his head in an air bubble that would keep him alive for the duration of what he now needed to do. He then ensnared Dog, feeling the ground below acquire the consistency of air, dropping his primordial body 10 paces beneath the surface before the stone solidified beneath his feet. As he strode forward, he forced Dog to make the earth through which he passed acquire a brownish-gray-tinged transparency, allowing Kraken to see. Feeling his throat tighten in anticipation, the sorcerer threw himself forward at a run, creating a furrow in the ground that solidified behind him and sending out a tremor that startled the soldiers who felt it. Within Kraken's head, Khalil's snarl rumbled. Standing in the midst of the swirling fog that flowed from her outstretched palms and fingers, Lycus felt the ground tremble. Clad in the same color-shifting Andarian uniform worn by Galad and the other warriors, she paused in her weaving of the mists. Her eyes roamed left and back to the right, seeing only the sunlit hillside glade within which she stood. The urge to glance back over her shoulder caused her to spin in place, but again, there was nothing to cause her concern. Here in this glade, time passed at twice the normal rate, much slower than the mists within which Galad's warriors moved. But this temporal zone formed a balanced progression, optimizing her ability to channel both the Rykli and slower Pommelly vapors. It also provided her excellent boundaries from which she could sense the disturbances within the shrouds she had created. As she turned her attention back to the evolving pattern that Galad was counting on her to continue to weave, a loud rumble caused her to spin around, just in time to see ahead and a pair of clawed hands sprout from the ground. For a mere handful of seconds, the sight of those slitted golden eyes in a face of unnatural beauty froze her in place as the being struggled to emerge. Its lips parted to reveal the incisors of a great cat, the expression startling Lycus back to her senses. In desperation, she shifted her channeling, only to cry out in agony and despair as icy limbs formed in the air around her, locking her body in place. Unable to make the motions required to summon new mists that would allow her to escape, she was forced to watch the being, who stood a head taller than she, step forward. Caressing her frozen cheek with a bronze hand, the primordial leaned in until she could feel his hot breath. She breathed in his musky scent and felt her heart stutter in her chest. Lycus managed a husky whisper.
"Who are you?"
"Some call me Kraken. Others name me Khalil. It matters not, for now we are one." The horror that filled her soul at this admission lent Lycus one last burst of strength, but as she flexed her fingers to open a mist channel, the claws on that bronze hand ripped out her throat. Galad swept in and out of fog, his elegantly inscribed sword spraying blood in an arc as he and his warriors wreaked havoc on the thousands of confused enemy soldiers who struggled to get clear of the clinging Pommelly mist. As if in a carefully choreographed dance, he moved forward and back, whirling into strikes that severed limbs and heads, his long tresses whipping about him. Those of his enemies who managed to get all the way into the Rykli mist, within which Galad fought, found themselves underprepared and overmatched. Raw terror filled the eyes of many of the human soldiers who tried to re-enter the fog bank from which they had just emerged, only to be shoved back by those still trying to charge ahead. That there were no vorgs or wielders of magic among the ranks of the enemy his warriors laid waste to on this battlefield surprised Galad. Vorgs made up the bulk of Kragan's army. The wielder was obviously sacrificing his conscripts in a mass attack into the haze, filling Galad with a growing sense of unease. What purpose was he failing to divine within this carnage? When the mist stopped flowing, seeming to freeze in place, Gallet felt as if a swarm of ants had crawled up his spine. There could be only one reason behind the enemy's ploy. Lycus was in trouble. Gallet signaled the retreat and crossed into another of the Rikely mists, repeating the pattern until he knew time sped his steps to a dozen times normal. The winding sunlit path between the other time mists led him up the steep slope between the thick trunks of blue spruce. As he approached the murky barriers that surrounded the glade where Lycus had stationed herself, he slowed almost to a stop, gradually forcing himself through the resistance of the slowing vapors that reduced the passage of time. And as he emerged into each of these new regions, the fog melted away to again bathe his body in sunlight, even as the mists closed in behind him. Always leading with his head and arms, he readied himself for the surprising dangers these new zones could bring. But instead of danger, he found death. Lycus lay in the middle of the glade, surrounded by the unmoving wisps. Blood from the jagged hole where her throat had once been covered her uniform and pooled around her body, matting her hair. Her eyes stared out of a face locked in an expression he had first took for terror. But as he knelt to take her hand in his, Gallet was shocked to see that her face shone with passion, such as he had only seen during their lovemaking. Feeling a tremble make its way from his hand into the rest of his body, Gallet blinked away tears, raised her fingers to his lips, and gently kissed them as his warriors spread out around the glade to defend it. No attack came. When Gallet released her hand to slowly rise to his feet, he turned to the warrior who stood at his side. Captain Tempest, his second in command, was easily recognizable by the much lighter skin of the scar that carved a path from her hairline across the bridge of her nose. At 93, she was just entering middle age, but had proven herself his most adept mist warrior and a charismatic leader. Despite her knowledge that this death meant that the mist Lycus had created would shortly fade away, Tempest's eyes held only sympathy for his loss. With a shuddering breath, Gallet forced himself to focus on the danger that now confronted them all.
"Send runners to all my commanders. Have them tell of the death of Lycus, and that I have ordered the retreat to our rally point. Then, assign a warrior to carry her body. As soon as you have completed that task, we move. We must be far from here before the mists dissipate."
Slapping palm to fist in salute, Tempest turned and strode away. With one last look at his fallen lover, Gallet allowed fury to shunt aside his grief. Then he shifted his gaze to the tale that the ground told him, a furrow where rock and soil had been pushed aside to form a mound where none had previously existed, could mean only one thing. Elemental magic of the earthen variety had been at work here. He could smell the evil taint of it on the mountain air. Gallet wanted to charge into his enemies, cutting a swath all the way to Kragan, sure that only the ancient one who had assumed a primordial's form could have done this. No other could have overcome Lycus so easily. But with no timeshaper to support his assault, Gallet would only be sacrificing his mist warriors for vengeance. So as his grief robbed the strength from his limbs, Gallet led his followers along mist-shrouded pathways higher into the glacier mountains. 17. Ariana's Vale, Yore 415, Mid-Spring. If he had thought about it, Newton realized, he would have never come on this misbegotten, ill-thought-out adventure that was soon going to get him killed. He would have made his way to Hannington instead of journeying far from the comforts of Tal. Now, his panic attack on the cliffs had gotten him scorned, even by his own family. Everyone blamed him for what had happened to Corporal Jones, almost as if he had intended to get Jonesy killed. It wasn't even his fault. They had all known that he was terrified of heights before they had ordered him up on those cliffs. Hadn't he told them? Wasn't it blatantly obvious? And hadn't he tried to overcome his fears with an effort that enabled him to climb that terrible trail for some 300 feet before he had slipped? Little wonder that panic had overcome him as death tugged at his ankles. and so he stood here in the darkness, the drums hammering at the canyon walls as if to pull them down onto all those who waited. Newton was more scared now than he had been while dangling